Do you ever wonder how Supreme Court decisions impact our politics? Tune in to the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight, for a conversation with host Myla Adamus and guests Adam Cohen, author of Supreme Inequality, to find out just how this highest court has routinely bolstered the political power of conservatives. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nation Justice writer Ellie Mistal on Amy Coney Barrett and the future of the Supreme Court. Also on the program today, epic embarrassment of a debate that leaves Joe Biden better off. The undecided voters watched that and called Trump unhinged, but it probably won't affect their vote. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer forces an ACA vote, which I guess that means you can actually do stuff like that. Democrats to move ahead in the House on a new COVID aid bill. Meanwhile, the White House signals an openness to potential deal. New report, even pre-pandemic, Americans were losing health insurance. Joining the airlines, Disney now to lay off 28,000 employees. Federal court upholds Wisconsin voting extension deadline. Meanwhile, Trump plans a new COVID rally in Green Bay. The governor of New Jersey has signed a budget which raises the millionaire tax. Fund pandemic shortfalls, and in Philadelphia, activists win a fight to get 50 city properties turned into community housing. And lastly, a massive snafu in Brooklyn with absentee ballots. Turns out it's an upstate Republican-linked firm that did it. All this and more on today's program. You know, this story about the absentee ballots that were incorrectly addressed to about 100,000 Brooklyn voters. And hopefully they're going to be able to resend these ballots. This is for the November 3rd election. I mean, I think they should have plenty of time. But of course, it's going to make a difference on some level. No bid contract, I think it was $4.5 million, $4.6 million to a company upstate associated with the Republicans. But I think many times sheer incompetence is what explains this. The corruption and the malfeasance comes in when it's like, we're just doing this to, we're giving this contract to buddies of ours, as opposed to the most competent outfit out there. And that's why you see the sort of confluence between no bid contracts and failure. But important thing to note, because we've had plenty of times in the past where we get snafus like this and people perceive it as being ideological as opposed to sort of just typical graft and corruption and incompetence that is bred by that. So meanwhile, I'm a little tired. I stayed up and watched that debacle last night. I got to be honest with you. It was painful, but what was even more painful was watching any clip of it today. Because it's sort of, the dynamic is sort of like this. If you are in a dumpster for long enough, hanging out, the smell, you don't recognize it anymore. But if you step out of the dumpster and you go and you take a shower and then you come back to the dumpster, you realize like, wow, this smells really bad. The polls, the instant polls afterwards basically had Joe Biden winning. The best analysis I heard last night was from my 15-year-old daughter, who texted me right after the debates. And she said, this was the most embarrassing thing ever. Worst thing ever. And then she asked me for 15 minutes more on her screen time app. When I spoke to her after the debate, she expressed a sentiment that my guess is that to the extent that there are any voters out there who are watching this, who are undecided, and there's two big qualifiers there, right? I mean, I think there are voters out there who just don't pay attention to this stuff and they haven't made up their minds. They haven't probably even thought about it that much, the election. But for people who are actively engaged enough to want to watch a debate and are undecided, I mean, that's got to be a very narrow margin. I would like to meet people like that. It's hard for me to imagine that there are people out there who are like actively engaged in this election and undecided, but I'm sure they exist. To a certain extent, I think the dynamic for those people is just like, wow, Donald Trump was just super rude. And my daughter expressed some empathy with Joe Biden. She's not a huge Joe Biden fan. She's a young person, but she did feel like he was mean to him. And when he was talking about his son, Trump was mean about it. And I actually think that that is probably as close as you can get to a sense of how someone who would be engaged in politics or engaged in the election, I should say, still be undecided. That seems to me to be as much of a cue in which to make your voting decision as anything else at that point. So we shall see. This was the other sort of interesting thing to watch is to watch the people on Fox News and all the surrogates try and, I don't know, salvage some of this out of this. And much of the problem that they're having comes around Donald Trump's refusal, or I should say reluctance, to answer the question directly, at first anyways, will you condemn the white supremacists, the extremists, the militias? That, incidentally, his own Department of Homeland Security says is one of the greatest threats to national security, right? I mean, this isn't just moralizing. This is like a national security issue, according to the national security apparatus. And the funny thing is to watch the Fox and Friends or other Fox hosts attempt to justify this. Listen to how Brian Kilmeade does this. It doesn't even occur to him, like, why can't Trump hit the layup?
And if you're going to say that President Trump was rude, there was only one person who called the other one a clown, a racist, the worst president ever, and told to shut up. And that was Joe Biden on Donald Trump. But Donald Trump blew the biggest layup in the history of debates by saying, not condemning white supremacists. I don't know if he didn't hear it, but he's got to clarify that right away. That's like, are you against evil? Why the president didn't just knock it out of the park, I'm not sure.
You know, let's ruminate on that. What causes someone to miss a layup like that? Sometimes you get a little bit nervous. Kilmeade suggesting maybe he didn't hear the question. But why he didn't knock it out of the park, I don't know. I wonder why it would take 4 years to sort of like assess, like, why would that be hard for him to condemn white supremacists and extremists. Why would that be hard? Maybe because he doesn't want to alienate any of his supporters? Well, but let's give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he didn't hear the question. Let's tune in, shall we?
You have repeatedly criticized.
I have to answer his statement.
You've been talking back and forth.
He made a statement.
I'm asking you.
I would love to end it.
You know, if you want to switch seats,
That part of the exchange that didn't involve Joe Biden is an example of, I think, why, to a certain extent, if there are any undecided voters, they could get turned off from Donald Trump. I mean, it's one thing to attack, you know, the libs or the Democrat or whatever it is. But it's another to sort of, poor Chris Wallace. Why? What did he do? Go ahead.
National Guard, it would be over. There'd be no problem.
Okay.
But they don't want to accept the National Guard.
You have repeatedly criticized the vice president for not specifically calling out Antifa and other left-wing extremist groups. But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
to
specifically
that, but
do it?
Well, I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a
FBI director.
This is a left-wing problem.
White supremacist. Antifa's an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not militia. That's what FBI director
Gentlemen,
said.
Well, then you know what?
We're done, sir. We're moving on to the next. We're moving
on. If that hits you over the head, that's not an idea.
Gosh, jeez. Much funnier version, I think, with Walter Matthau and George Burns. I think it was called The Sunshine Boys. Maybe he didn't hear the question, although it was pretty explicit. Maybe he was just trying to like get stand down and couldn't find it and was just like stand back and stand by or whatever it was. But this is a guy who's reluctant to criticize his... Now, has he come out and clarified this yet? I would imagine he's going to. But if they were serious about it, they would have done it last night. They're just seeing how it plays today. They just don't like the fact that Proud Boys are now, let's put this up. Proud Boys are now marketing out off of this. They're so excited. This is the best thing that ever happened to the Proud Boys. Do we have their merch? Do we have a picture of their merch? Look at this. Yeah, they've actually integrated it with their logo now. So there's how many have we seen the correction yet? I mean, it's been 15 hours. So I think largely the big story is that Joe Biden managed to make it through the entire debate. And Donald Trump, I think, to a large extent, just made himself look bad. He couldn't help himself. I don't know if he feels like he needs to rally his own base or if he's just incapable of even for a moment. It started out, right? Didn't you guys think that it started out like he was going to do? I was sort of suggesting, I think at one point yesterday, that like he may come out and try and be presidential to try and salvage, sort of like do what he did at the, what they tried to do for him at the RNC, you know, sort of give license to those Republican women voters in the suburbs that, oh, he's not such a bad guy. That seemed to go minute. It seemed to me like that's what he was going for. And then he couldn't maintain.
He's like, hi, Joe. Good to see you. Oh, we're both at this debate, like a bit of cordiality out front.
Exactly.
And then the second it got a little bit conflicted, then Trump lost his discipline.
Right. Exactly. It's like, you can imagine like all these campaign people looking at each other in that first minute going like, oh my God, he's doing it. And then it's gone away. Right at the beginning, he just seemed like he was
Here's what Trump tweeted after the debate. Sort of like a Street Fighter sort of...
I'm taking out two guys.
Oh, I see. So the argument is he was going against both those guys. But, mm-hmm. you know, the problem is that I don't think that his fans necessarily... I mean, Chris Wallace has not been, you know, cuddling up to him like everyone else at Fox News. But I just don't think, you know, it's not like he's working for the New York Times. It's not like he's... Chris Wallace is a woman. It's not like he's a woman of color. It's much harder for Trump to demonize Chris Wallace. And that was the other thing that I found really disturbing about the debate. You know, like, God, so white, so old. And then I'm sitting there covering it. It was like, it's four, you know, relatively old to old white guys. That was my experience of the debate. Including myself, not that anybody, you know, I mean, just we had people watching it on YouTube, but man, if there was like a fast forward to this era, I would hit that button hard. It would be broken right now. It'd be rubbed off. You wouldn't know which button it was, except for the fact that it was the one that all the writing on the button was rubbed off.
Well, obviously, Sam, you have not seen the Adam Sandler classic Click. And the consequences of fast forwarding through certain moments of your life.
I did not see that, Brendan. Maybe I should watch that. Just
maybe Matthew Film Guy can give us a review for Friday or something.
Today's program is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. And boy, after that debate, they are giving our audience 10% off. This is for your first month. When you go to betterhelp.com/majority report, you've heard me talk about BetterHelp in the past. It gives you access to your own fully licensed and fully accredited therapist via phone, via chat, video, however you feel most comfortable doing it. As you know, during this era of coronavirus, things can be pretty difficult, therapists tend, particularly now, because of the way that things are operating, they have long wait lists. It can take a week sometimes to go see a therapist. It can take months before they can see you. So when you sign up with BetterHelp, here's the difference. They match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and they match you with them so that you will be communicating with that therapist within 24 hours. Now is a great time to try out. If you've never been to therapy, great time to do it. Obviously, if you've been in therapy in the past, everything is remote these days for the most part. BetterHelp is a great way to do remote therapy. Because once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time. And you can do that for any reason for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. These therapists have specialties that may not even be available in your area or tough to find. BetterHelp has them. They also tend to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. .com/majority report. All right, we're going to take a quick break just for a moment, and
actually we'll bring Ellie on.
Okay, we have him. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine, Ellie Mistal. Ellie, how are you?
I'm, you know, PTSD from last night. trying to recover.
Exactly, that's exactly what you said. Yeah, that was something. I mean, I want to touch on that, but in the context of the Supreme Court, I mean, it's really hard to sort of look at that debate last night and think that if people came away, you know, to the extent that they, the debates mean change anybody's mind. And that's also sort of a hard thing to contemplate. It certainly wasn't based upon any type of issue set. It was really just like, I don't know. You know what it reminded me of was, you know, that scene in the movie, the classic, like after school special where the sympathetic kid gets beat up by the bully, and the girl that sympathetic kid, you know, has a crush on finally recognizes him and goes over and says, "Let me help you. I'm sorry." And that's the way they start their relationship. I think that's what happened. I think Joe Biden may have picked up a couple of votes in that fashion because Trump was just being just out of control.
I mean, if we're gonna go to childhood pop culture, I'm reminded of this every Scooby-Doo episode where the villain is finally unmasked, and he's like, "I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you crazy black people." I mean, that's look. I
don't remember
one,
that.
That maybe was just what I heard. One of the ways I've been trying to explain the debate is that if you did that thing that they do at singers now sometimes where they drop out all the accompaniment and you just hear their raw voice, so you can see how Adele sounds so beautiful with no auto-tune or anything like that. If you dropped out all the accompaniment, what Donald Trump said clearly was he wants to put Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court so she can hand him the election, to the extent that the Proud Boys aren't able to intimidate enough voters on their own. That was the through line through all the insults and interruptions and crazy talk. That was the through line. He started with the acknowledgement that the reason why he wants to put Barrett on the court before the election is so she can hand him the election. He said that clearly, and then he clearly said that he wants white supremacists to engage in voter intimidation. That's the narrative of this debate. He's telling us his plan.
Yeah, and you know, he's done that in the past, right? I mean, he always seems to tell the subtext. And you know, you can imagine his advisors or whoever it is, maybe it's Roger Stone, basically laying it out. This has been my theory for a while, is that the Proud Boys are going to go in, they're going to interfere with the voting and the counting enough so that certain deadlines become either pass or crunched in terms of like certification and getting electors. And then the things start to move to the courts. And that's, you know, sort of some version, essentially what happened in 2000, which, of course, Amy Coney Barrett just coincidentally also was, I think, you know, sort of working on that case on some level, not high up. But
if she gets on the court, Amy Coney Barrett will be the third Supreme Court justice that kind of got their legal start or rose to legal fame through Bush v. Gore. John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett all worked for Bush on Bush v. Gore. People need to remember what the actual issue was in the Florida 2000 Bush v. Gore lawsuit. Florida was trying to conduct a recount of its votes, and the Supreme Court stopped the recount in Florida, saying that there was no way to do that constitutionally. So in a situation that we have now in Florida, and
specifically because they did not want to create the sense that Bush was not president, because that would be prejudicial against him.
Exactly. So instead, so in 2000, we had stop the recount. I think in 2020, the lawsuit is going to be stop the count, right? We know there are going to be a lot of mail-in ballots. We know they're not all going to be counted on election day night. At that point, Trump and his lawyers will sue for an injunction to make certain states stop counting their mail-in ballots. That will percolate up through the system. And what he's doing is positioning Roberts and Kavanaugh and Barrett, who have all, again, already made this argument, to align with Thomas and Gorsuch, who we know are Thomas and Alito, who we know are like crazy, to force these states to stop counting ballots that have been submitted legally and officially, stop counting them before they are able to tell us the result of the election in their states. That is the plan. That is what they are trying to do. Trump is no longer trying to win the election. People need to understand that, right? Like, if you look at that debate point, that was not the debate performance of a candidate who is down trying to appeal to the broadest swath of voters. That was the debate performance of a candidate who does not care that he is losing the election in terms of votes. It's a candidate. It was a debate performance of a candidate who is planning on stealing the election, and thus he does not have to care about losing it.
Yeah, I think he's. I think he's sort of modeling the behavior that he wants his followers to engage in going forward, which is like, everybody's against us. We're going to fight until we win, period. It doesn't matter what, you know, what that looks like or how we go about doing that. All right. Well, that also, I think, aptly describes Mitch McConnell's behavior over the course of, I don't know, at least 6, 8 years, 12 years, maybe now. I mean, and it has culminated. I don't know from Mitch McConnell's perspective how you could say anything other than mission accomplished beyond my wildest dreams. Right? I mean, he probably got Trump elected by holding that seat open. He ended up getting 3 seats. You know, maybe you could argue 2 because Kennedy may have held out for another couple of years and not retired had it been a Democratic president. But 2 to 3 seats. He's got over 200 federal judges, lifetime appointments, breaking records, essentially, in terms of speed. Let's talk about Amy Coney Barrett. I don't know. You want to start with, is there anything the Democrats can do? Well, let's first talk about her, and then we'll talk about why and what Democrats can do to at least slow the roll.
Yeah, so in terms of her actual record, her record is one of an extreme conservative. We can debate whether or not it's okay to be extreme conservative, but make no mistake that her positions are outside of the mainstream, even of her own party. It's why so often she is in dissent when she is on the Seventh Circuit. Her views on abortion are well documented. She has not had the opportunity to directly rule on an abortion related case, but she has said that that abortion is always a moral. She has said falsely that Roe v. Wade creates a quote framework for abortion on demand. That is patently untrue. Roe v. Wade creates a framework where the state can limit or restrict abortions after fetal liability. She has said that a good Catholic judge should recuse themselves on issues where the Catholic Church's teachings are in kind of direct conflict with secular law. But she did that. She said that in the context of death penalty decisions. She has not said that in the context of abortion decisions, which is point and click hypocritical, right? So
let's stay on this for a moment, because this is sort of fascinating. She wrote this in a law review article. So, I mean, so to be fair, you know, we're talking about, it was, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, maybe. She has been a professor at Notre Dame University, or prior to being on the Seventh Circuit, incidentally, on a seat that was blocked.
Already stolen, right?
Like another example, more or less like the Merrick Garland story. It's just that it doesn't get much attention because it's a federal, a seat. And I mean, excuse me, it's a judicial
lower court
as opposed to the justice, right? And so she wrote in this law review article, and now it's possible that, you know, she's evolved in her thinking of this, although I don't know that she's on record at talking about evolving her thinking on this. But the argument she was making is that if you believe in the canon of Catholicism in the way that she does, then it is incumbent upon you to recuse yourself from cases that conflict with this. Now, I don't know, like, look, from my perspective, one's relationship with your religion is your own business. And if you feel that your relationship with anything causes you to recuse yourself, then you should. But she's out there making an ethical or a moral or an ideological or a legal argument that there's no reason to think that it would just apply to the death penalty as opposed to abortion. It just so happens that maybe ideologically those Catholics are on the wrong side of the death penalty for her tastes. But that to me, like in Dianne Feinstein tried to talk about this in her Seventh Circuit and it blew up in her face, because Dianne Feinstein does not have the ability to sort of articulate this.
Yeah, look, Sam, this is an interesting point to me because I can live at that speed. I can accept a judge who says, you know what, I have a moral feeling about this issue or about this law. My moral feeling is in conflict with an impartial application of secular law, and so I am going to step back. I am going to not be a judge in this case. I actually think the system would be better if judges recused themselves more often. Like
this doesn't have to be religion, right? I mean, I don't believe in the death penalty. I'm a judge, though. The law says the death penalty exists. But I got to say, I don't believe that we should be doing this. I'm against the law, so I need to recuse myself because I cannot be impartial in adjudicating this, whether it's because of my religion or just because, you know, I'm a good person in my mind or something.
One of the reasons why we have multiple judges on appellate courts is not so we can be locked in this endless right-left liberal-conservative battle. It is because there are situations where a good, decent judge understands that they cannot rule impartially on every freaking issue under the sun. And so I think we would live in a better world if more judges, quite frankly, followed Amy Coney Barrett's argument in that particular law review article. My problem with Amy Coney Barrett is that argument that she made in her law review article, she applies hypocritically. So if you're going to say that you should recuse yourself from a death penalty case, if you're basically going to say that you morally do not think the state should be involved in killing somebody, but you will not stand in front of the state to stop them from killing somebody, then by the same moral teachings, you should recuse yourself on a woman's right to choose, which is clearly allowed under secular law. 50 years of Supreme Court precedent says so. Her moral beliefs on abortion should not matter. And since she has already put herself on the record that they do matter to her, she should recuse herself from issues of women's choice and women's rights. Of course, she won't.
She won't.
Hence the hypocrisy, right? She should recuse herself on Eighth Amendment cases, right? But she won't. Instead, she rules for a robust version of cruel and unusual punishment, right? She does not protect people from cruel and unusual punishment. She thinks that cruel and unusual punishment is basically okay, according to her record. So it is the aspect of Amy Coney Barrett's judicial philosophy that is hypocritical with her faith that I find issues, not the application of her faith in or her seeming willingness to take her faith out of the mix on one specific issue, right? That's fine, but she should do it for all the rest.
And it's not just that it's hypocritical relative to her faith. It's hypocritical in that she has created an ethical, or even you could argue legal principle, because it has to do with the recusal from for a judge. And she applies that completely inconsistently.
Exactly.
I'm perfectly okay with the idea that, like, well, I'm not as attached to the concept of the death penalty as I am abortion, and that's the way I practice my faith, yada yada yada, whatever it is. But she's the one who created this standard, which is if you happen to be 100% bought into a certain canon, then you need to step aside. And she's not doing that. So what else? I mean, what else do we know about her as a judge? Because I think the right has been very explicit over the years about Amy Coney Barrett and Roe v. Wade. I mean, I think I could have named, I don't know, well, maybe a couple more, but there's not many federal judges I can name. Her name has been bandied about for even before she was in the judiciary as the vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, because she was a woman and she is so reliable in that regard. But she's also an incredible right winger when it comes to a bunch of other stuff too.
Yeah, she's an extremist. And this is, talking to non-lawyers sometimes, I struggle to make this point in a way that slaps, right? That really sticks in their head. The kind of person who was willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. People kind of think that, oh, that's just a moral issue, or, you know, a legal, like they just don't agree with one, you know, particular Supreme Court ruling. Roe v. Wade is settled precedent. It's 50 years old. It has been upheld multiple times. It has been shaped and molded by other cases like Planned Parenthood v. Casey. To be the kind of judge who thinks that they can just throw out that precedent, that's the kind of person who's willing to throw out a whole bunch of other stuff, right? Like you, like it's a one-to-one connection. You can't have a person who's willing to ignore precedent on this issue and isn't willing to ignore precedent on a whole bunch of other issues that they just don't like. And so Amy Coney Barrett has a lot of issues that she just doesn't like, and she doesn't think precedent is that important. She has in fact written also about how she thinks that basically if the precedent disagrees with your moral compass, you should ignore the precedent, which is a crazy extremist theory for any federal judge to hold. Amy Coney Barrett has written that theory down. And so it comes at you in so many different ways. One of the things that I try to make the point to people is how she thinks about precedent when it comes to Chevron deference. Now, Chevron deference is not a term.
I'm actually just going to raise that, but let me. Oh, I want to get to the Chevron deference because this is a huge issue that I don't think that people, you know, we've talked about on this program, but I don't think they fully appreciate. But just to, I want to just put a finer point on that part about you know you're expressing something that sometimes doesn't stick to people who don't have sort of a legal framework in which to view the law. You know, we're seeing attacks on the sort of the norms in the context of the Senate, but the fact of the matter is that those norms in and of themselves, they change and this and that, and that's sort of part of it, and that's, it's still a political process. The one concept that supposedly anchors the law, because it is the law at the end of the day, and it's supposed to work without having to bring out police officers, you know, on your opinion, because then you're just in brute force, is that the concept of stare decisis, the concept of if law is settled, to overturn that is the most radical, basic, like earth-shattering thing you should do, and it should only be done with the greatest care and in the most extreme, you know, like, just it has to be, it's very hard to come up with a justification to do that when you're talking about a law that society has absorbed for 50 years. And so her willingness to overthrow that simply because of a moral consciousness that she has, when it's clear where the society is on this, is completely nuts, right? That's the whole point.
It's such a critical point. We have to remember these judges are unelected. They are unaccountable to the popular will, right? The only reason why we allow them to wield that power, that unelected, unaccountable power, is because we are supposed to be able to trust them to apply the law faithfully. And applying the law faithfully means respecting precedent, right? So like you can talk about abortion, you can talk about the right to privacy, you can talk about birth control, you can talk about a whole host of things. But the thing that a judge is supposed to do is to understand that if we have prior decisions, if we have precedent on an issue, the judge should not change precedent. That's the legislature's responsibility to change precedent, right? That's the constitutional amendment's responsibility to change precedent. You should not change precedent unless it is, as you were pointing out, an egregious kind of misuse of law that society has long since moved beyond, right? So like when we finally get around to overruling Plessy v. Ferguson and ending segregation, right? Society had that is the level at which you're supposed to be willing to relook and reexamine established precedent. And Amy Coney Barrett is saying straight up, she should be able to overturn precedent whenever she feels like it. That's just not a position that normal federal judges take.
And that's why you'll hear folks like Amy Coney Barrett, and I don't know if she's done it specifically, but certainly this is a technique to compare it to Dred Scott, because they want to put it within that pantheon of there have been, we traditionally, for whatever it was, 100, 200 years, treated a certain segment of our population, certain people, as if they were not human in the context of our society. They were commodities. You want to put it on that level and to try and overcome the 50 years of this, but the circumstances are just not there. I mean, it's conceivable, I guess, that in 100 years we would come to sort of like feel that like, women are just vessels for procreation because of the nature of what has happened in society. I mean, God help us if that happens, or anything help us. But that's not what's going on here in that instance.
And people need to understand the fight against Roe v. Wade is not a fight against abortion. It's a fight against the legal concept of a right to privacy. When the precedent that she's overturning is the precedent that women have a right to privacy,
autonomy over their body.
So it's not just a question of abortion rights. It goes right to birth control rights, right? Like the first time the right to privacy was recognized by the Supreme Court was not in Roe v. Wade. It was in Griswold v. Connecticut, which is about a woman trying to get birth control. It is something that I don't know that most people can kind of grasp, but the long-term conservative fight here is not against abortion. Abortion is the hill, is the flag that they want to wave, but what they're really going after in the long term is abortion. Is birth control. And that is what Amy Coney Barrett is here to do too.
All right. So, but let's now move on to the Chevron doctrine or deference doctrine, which is, it's one of those things that is a little bit obscure, but impacts almost every single breath we take, everything that we put into our mouths, every place, every time we travel somewhere, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So here's my 2 second explanation of Chevron deference. Everybody understands that we have lots of executive agencies, right? The FDA, the EPA, all these agencies running around. All these agencies make rules, right, about what means clean water and whether or not we should have a vaccine and things of that, kind of nature, right? Why do people follow these rules? Because of this legal concept that was first articulated in a case involving the Chevron Oil Corporation. And the issue is that when a federal agency makes a rule, like the EPA, like the FDA, like the FCC, when the federal agency makes a rule, the courts should treat that rule with the force of law. It's why it's called deference, is because when something is a law, the courts are supposed to kind of try to assume that such law is real and constitutional and carries forces and effects, right? When justices talk about overturning Chevron deference, what they are talking about directly is ignoring laws made by the federal agencies and imposing their own will and interpretation of congressional statutes over and above what the federal agencies have said. So FDA says, oh, we can't have a vaccine until certain targets are met. Court says, nah, we're not going to listen to that. EPA says, oh, to have clean water, we need X, Y, and Z. Court says, nah, we don't. Like that, the people who want to overturn Chevron deference, that's what they want to do. They want to superimpose a judge's or an appellate court's interpretation of law over the professionals in the executive agencies. That is why, and this is my last point here, that is why every person who even thinks they might care about climate change, whether you're a hardcore Green New Deal person or just a regular old person who has kids and want them to be able to grow up without sprouting gills. If you care at all about environmental regulation, then you deeply care about Chevron deference. Because if you don't have Chevron deference, then you don't have an EPA that is allowed to do anything. That is the one-to-one connection.
And so the idea is that when Congress makes a law, they don't know in the future what chemical somebody might find in the water that it causes a neural damage, let's just say, as an example. So they leave it up. They leave a certain amount of it, of birth, to the EPA to determine, like, it's basically keep the water safe. And the EPA goes out and creates a grid to determine what keeps the water safe. We have this evidence that if you ingest this much of a chemical over the course of a certain time, then the water's not safe. But maybe if you have a little bit less, it is safe. There's no way for the Congress to actually do that every single day. They don't have the expertise. They don't have the time. They can't see into the future. And basically, it's the Chevron deference that allows the EPA to do that. The court doesn't care if they want to stop them from, like, hey, that's going to cost too much for that company to actually dispose of that chemical as opposed to dumping it in the river. Boom, that's it. And there's no, I mean, once the Chevron, is there even a way for Congress to fix that? Like they can fix it on that specific chemical, but I'm saying, is there a way for the Congress to sort of say, like, you've got to broadly apply that doctrine that you developed in the Chevron case?
It's hard to legislate Chevron deference, right? You could pass some kind of legislation that basically instructs the courts to listen to the executive agencies, but you'd have to kind of do that legislation with each law you pass, right? So you pass the Clean Air Act, and then you have to tack on, and this act will be interpreted according to the strictures of the EPA. Blah, blah, blah. So you'd have to do that every time with every law. It is possible to overcome a court who does not respect Chevron deference, but it is super hard, and it means that I think in a more immediate sense, it means so many of the laws that we have already on our books become functionally useless, right? Like that's the real kind of immediate term effect. So, like, yeah, you can pass a new Clean Water Act that reinstitutes Chevron deference for clean water, but you have to pass a whole new act, and we had trouble passing the first one, right? So it makes everything once again back into the political arena, and that's just bad for our health and safety. I focus on the EPA because I care about climate change, but I mean, it's as simple as, you know, the Congress passing a law saying, you know, make sure planes don't fall out of the sky, and the National Transportation Board making rules about how to make sure planes don't fall out of the sky, and then the court coming in and saying, oh, Boeing, you don't have to listen to those rules. That was just the Transportation Safety Board. You don't have to listen to them. Congress just said make planes safe. We think that whatever Boeing says makes planes safe. Like that, it goes to so many kind of basic aspects of our safety just running around the country.
And we should just make it clear what it's going to mean is that how many of those planes have to crash before Congress realizes, like, oh, we've got a problem now and we have to pass another bill. And if not enough people die, there may not be the political will to do it.
And if we have divided government, if Congress is controlled by one party, but the Senate is controlled by a different party, like passing new legislation takes a long time. We have Chevron deference to make our system efficient. Coney Barrett is absolutely dead set against Chevron deference. She would join Neil Gorsuch, who is also absolutely dead set against Chevron deference. I think you still have Roberts, but it's part, again, there are long term goals that the conservatives have with the Supreme Court, and they do not start and they do not end with abortion. Abortion is just the thing that they use when they need to get the crazies activated. They talk about abortion, but there is a whole smorgasbord of things that conservatives want that people like Amy Coney Barrett support.
Lastly, let me ask you this. What can be done now? I mean, is this a fait accompli? Or let me put it this way. It can be both a fait accompli, and there can be things that can be done that can at very least sort of set up a response to it. Does that make sense?
Yes. To me, it absolutely makes sense.
You and I, because, people understand what I just said.
Right. Because there is not a lot that being done to stop any Coney Barrett in the immediate term. There's simply too much time left on the clock. There are delaying tactics and stunts. I think the Democrats should use them all. I'm actually disappointed that the Democrats are not more invested in using some stunts right now. There are delaying tactics and stunts that can potentially push her nomination back until after the election. But Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell have already indicated that they are willing to push this justice through a lame duck session of Congress. They are literally willing to have senators, some of whom may have lost their reelection bid, vote to confirm a justice who will sit on the court for 40 years. There is too much time left on the clock between the election and the inauguration to delay it all the way through to January 21st. I just can't get us there with parliamentary politics, right? So if they're committed to doing it in the lame duck, they will get it done in the lame duck. After that, if Joe Biden wins and is allowed to take office, which is a whole different problem, and is allowed to take office on January 20th, then the only thing the Democrats can do is expand the number of justices on the court. I've heard lots of interesting ideas. I know there's a bill in Congress right now about term limits. I love term limits. I think they're constitutional. I'm not on the Supreme Court. And the people who are on the Supreme Court do not think it's constitutional. Democrats think that they might be losing that 5-4. There is right now only one justice on the Supreme Court who has even indicated the possibility that he thinks term limits would be constitutional. That's Stephen Breyer. I think you lose a term limits case 8-1 in front of the Supreme Court right now. If you want term limits, you need to expand the court with justices who think term limits are constitutional. If you want statehood for D.C., you need to expand the court with justices who think that D.C. and Puerto Rico can and should be states. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. There is nothing that you want that survives a court that stacks 6-3 with Republicans. That's why Republicans stack the court, specifically to be a bulwark against the progressive agenda should they ever lose popular power. That is why they've stacked them. To overcome that, you must meet their game and raise them. You must expand the Supreme Court with your own slate of justices. That is the play. That is the only play.
And the point of gumming up the works right now, at the very least, there may be ancillary benefits to it as well. But the point of doing that now and pushing it into the lame duck is because them confirming a judge in the lame duck session, if the senators have lost and Joe Biden is the president-elect, becomes an even easier jumping board or springboard to court packing, to court expansion and these other reforms, right? Exactly. I mean, that's bottom line. And so if you don't take the opportunity to gum up the works now, one of the reasons you may not do that is because you want to lessen pressure on you if you are in the leadership and in the majority later from actually making these reforms.
There's also just straight up the issue, we've touched on it already, but there's straight up the issue that delaying Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation until after the election means that that's one less vote to hand Trump the election.
Yep.
So it is absolutely worth it for Democrats to do everything they can to push the nomination until after the election. And I don't see them doing everything they can. I see them resistant to engage in really base and cynical political parliamentarian stunts. I understand that it might seem icky to them, but we are beyond icky. All right. We're in a knife fight to save our democracy. We got to bring everything that we have to bear. And that includes icky political stunts.
They got one job. And that's the job they should be doing. Ellie Mistel, justice correspondent for The Nation magazine. Always a pleasure. I don't know if that was your kid back there, but we're cash here. It's okay. You don't have to worry about that.
Dude, homeschooling is a whole different.
I know. Thanks so much, Ellie. Appreciate
struggle
it.
Struggle is real. Thank you so much, Sam. Have a nice one.
You too. That is Ellie Mistel, folks. We'll put a link to his stuff at The Nation magazine. Coming back, the Adam Gentleson, He was a former staffer, chief of staff, I should say, for Harry Reid from Nevada. Harry Reid was, he evolved politically over the years. I mean, I'm not going to say this guy was he's not a democratic socialist by any stretch of the mean, but he was very, very protective of Social Security. But he also was exceptionally good at being a leader of the Democrats and getting into fights. He was not afraid to get into fights. He was not afraid to push things in a way, let's say, maybe Chuck Schumer might be. Now, Schumer, just kudos to him for forcing a vote on the ACA that's going to put Republicans in a uncomfortable position, specifically as to whether they should tell the DOJ to back off the lawsuit that they're pursuing to destroy the ACA. But what's really important here is to push that pick into the lame duck. Because again, we're talking about politics. And the idea of them confirming a justice now, still pretty outrageous based upon what they did in the final term of Obama or the final year of Obama's presidency with Merrick Garland. But to do so after Donald Trump has lost the presidency, after many of those senators, this is potential, voting on this confirmation will not be senators in a month, makes it even more egregious. And the more egregious, the more costly politically, the seating this justice is, the better for Democrats, because they'll have more opportunity to reform the courts. So Gentleson says every unanimous consent, essentially vote, should be contested. They should never get unanimous consent. There should always be at least one Democratic senator who says no, forcing a vote every time. It will gum up the works in multiple ways. It will deny committees the ability to meet more than 2 hours after the Senate convenes. You also need a quorum of 51 senators to do anything on the Senate floor. Democrats should not show up. Republicans have 53 senators. Make them all stay in D.C. to operate the Senate. It'll make it hard on them to campaign. It'll just make it hard on them, period. They should boycott, according to him, the judiciary hearings. Because if you go in there and you have arguments, it just comes off as a contentious hearing, like a million others these days. If you boycott, the record shows that something was extremely egregious. Those are the things that the Democrats should do. And then they use that as a springboard for this structural reform that we were just talking about with Ellie Mistel. We shall see if that happens. In the meantime, we are done here today. For you folks who listen or watch the first hour of the program, we will see you tomorrow. In the meantime, for the rest of us, we will be heading to the fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the first half of the show, and then we give you a second half of the show. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We now have a new carpenter pencils and new shirts. We got a posit shirt in the merch store at shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. Great way to keep up on all the happenings and stories that you don't hear other places. AMQuickie.com, 6 or 7 minutes every morning on your favorite podcast service. Or you can also see it on YouTube, too. We have it at the Majority Report Audio YouTube channel. Check out Noma Key's show. She did a debate wrap-up last night. I don't know who she got on for today. Dorsey didn't tell me, but check her out at 3 p.m. Her show's been great as of late. You can find that at youtube.com. The Nomiki Show, or patreon.com, The Nomiki Show. And Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we have a hot, fresh History is a Weapon coming at you. It's very topical. I just discovered what it was about when I looked at it just now, because I'm not in it. It's Sean and Matt Crispin from Chapo Trap House, two really smart guys who know a lot about history. This one is about a little thing called QAnon. So in this two-parter, Matt and Sean examine the political economy and prehistory of everyone's favorite far-right conspiracy movement. How his alienation and economic crisis combined to create a heady and perhaps dangerous mix of religious fervor and crackpot ideology. How does QAnon overlap with conspiracy theories of the past? How does it represent something new and different? The boys do their best to get their heads around it. So part one is out now, patreon.com/theantifada. And part two is coming out, I believe, for our patrons on Friday. So check it out, folks.
Matt, what happened on TMBS last night?
Last night on TMBS, we had a members-only pregame show where Gene Bajelan joined us to talk about the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict and sort of the global powers at play there. And then we covered the debate live for the full show, and that was super fun and, you know, not at all hard on, you know, sort of your heart rate or anything like that. So you can check that out at the Michael Brooks Show YouTube page and patreon.com/TMBS. And I'll probably be taken to the skies at twitch.tv/literary hangover in the next few days.
All right, folks, quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you in the fun half. Are we going to play that the board editor one?
Sure.
Okay, yeah, let's do that one. I just want to see that one again. So good.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are
sacrifice of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.